Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. This Wednesday, April 22nd, marks the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. This year, because of COVID-19, organizers are taking their calls to action and events online. So where are we this year? Well, we've never seen so much awareness raising, action on the streets, youth involvement, and media coverage. At the same time, the Trump administration is continuing its anti-science, anti-environmental policies, and its relentless efforts to weaken and dismantle environmental regulations, even during the COVID-19 pandemic. We have been covering that over the last couple of weeks. So on today's Your Call, we're talking about where we are and where we need to go with two guests. Michael Mann is professor of atmospheric science at Penn State with joint appointments in the Department of Geosciences and the Earth and Environmental Systems Institute and director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Michael Mann is the author of several books, including his most recent, The Madhouse Effect. Hi, Professor Mann. Welcome back to the show. Thanks so much for joining us. And we're also joined by Naomi Oreskes, professor of the history of science and an affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. Naomi Oreskes is the author and co-author of 7 books, including her most recent, Why Trust Science? It traces the history and philosophy of science from the late 19th century to today. Hi, Professor Oreskes. Welcome back to the show, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Nice to be with you today as well.
It's nice to have you. Naomi, before we dive in, I just wonder, how are you and your loved ones doing?
Oh, we're all fine. Thank you very much.
Okay, good. And Michael, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay,
we're doing
great.
well as well. Yep.
Okay, I'm so glad to hear it. Well, I want to start off by just talking with both of you about how COVID-19 is affecting your thinking about the climate crisis. We've done shows about the connections, for example, with air pollution. And Naomi, I want to start off with you because you wrote a piece for Time Magazine called We Need Big Government to Save Us from the Pandemic. So just tell us what you're thinking about the pandemic and climate change today.
Well, I think like a lot of things in the climate change story, we see good news and bad news. I think the good news is that COVID-19 has shown how much it matters that we have good science, that we listen to scientific expertise. We've seen very clearly in this case that countries that acted quickly and decisively on scientific evidence are showing much lower death rates than countries that didn't. So that's good in the sense that it's a clear vindication of the importance of science and the way in which science can help us to live better, safer, healthier, more prosperous lives. The bad news is that we have seen in the United States the consistent reluctance of the federal government to take clear action and a kind of emergence of what we could call coronavirus denial, the same sort of bad habits that we've seen over the last 4 decades, going back to Ronald Reagan, of being skeptical about scientific evidence, have been in full display here. And as I argued in my Time magazine case, as you noted, I think much of this can be explained by an ideological resistance to federal action, an ideological resistance to, quote, big government, but I wouldn't really call it big government, I really call it government, effective government, and the sort of ideological commitment to leaving things to the state or to the private sector or to individuals. And what we've seen so clearly here is that that has failed us. There are many things that can be left to individuals, but there are other big problems that can't. Climate change is one of those big problems that can't be solved by individuals alone, and so is COVID-19.
And you can read Professor Naomi Oreskes' article about needing effective government to save us from the pandemic at yourcallradio.org. Michael Mann, you wrote a piece with Lawrence Torsello in Newsweek called Seeing the COVID-19 Crisis is Like Watching a Time Lapse of Climate Change. Will the Right Lessons Be Learned? Tell us about your thoughts today.
Yes. I think, as Naomi has very nicely laid out, there are really two paths that we could follow at this point. There are different lessons that we can take away from it, and my hope is that we take away the right lessons. On the one hand, as Naomi has pointed out, this is an ultimate vindication of science. The scientific predictions, the model estimates were actually quite accurate. They were contingent, of course, upon the actions that we take. And there's a certain level of irony here, because some of the usual suspects, the forces of denial and delay who have tried to undermine action on climate, have also been trying to undermine action here on, you know, actually doing something to stem the spread of this pandemic. And the underlying reason is the same. It's ideological and it's monetary. There are powerful vested interests, be it the fossil fuel industry or the interests who essentially run the Trump administration, who had a vested interest in trying to avoid taking action, be it cutting carbon emissions to deal with climate change, or in this case, the lockdown that was necessary to stem the spread of this virus. That, of course, that lockdown represents a threat to the Trump administration and Trump's re-election chances. And the powerful vested interests, the fossil fuel industry, and others who have essentially used the Trump presidency to ram through their agenda of deregulation, recognize how important it is to keep Trump in office if they are to pursue, to continue to pursue their agenda, which, by the way, during the time that we've been dealing with this pandemic, there has been a massive assault on the part of the Trump administration on basic environmental protections, clean water, clean air, and, of course, various policies that were in place under the previous administration to deal with the problem of climate change and carbon emissions. And as we are distracted by this more acute, shorter-term crisis, the pandemic, they are meanwhile quietly essentially implementing their agenda of deregulation that is going to subject us to a far even greater crisis, which is the crisis of climate inaction, if we pursue this course that we're on.
So there are so many things to take on here. And Naomi, can you hear Michael?
I'm sorry? Hello?
Can you hear Michael Mann?
Yeah, I can. I couldn't at first, but it's all fine now. Thank you for asking.
Great.
I can barely hear Naomi, though.
Okay, so Michael can barely hear Naomi. If you can maybe turn that up. Thank you, Kevin. Hopefully we'll get that fixed. I'll ask you in a minute, Michael. Naomi, you and Michael both have very personal experience with denial. I mean, Naomi, you wrote an entire book about it. There's a documentary about this that you are in, and it's based on your book. And so I wonder, at a time when we are seeing so many people, I shouldn't say so many. These are loud protests. They're small protests. But this is important because these people are not wearing masks. They're not physically distancing. They're bashing science. We've seen reports about threats against Dr. Fauci calling COVID-19 a hoax. I mean, the list goes on and on. You know, we've got a ton of comments from Fox News hosts about, you know, they're basically spewing misinformation and dangerous information, really. So based on all the work that you've done on denial, Naomi, how do people effectively take this on?
Well, I think there's two important things to know. One is that we shouldn't really be surprised. I saw a great cartoon the other day that summed up in one cartoon everything I've been working on for the past 15 years. It actually made me feel very inadequate. But it shows a professor saying, if P, then Q. I don't like Q, therefore I reject P. And that really sums it up in a nutshell, right? Denial is all about rejecting things that you don't like, things you don't want to be true. And so in Merchants of Doubt, we show that the rejection of science, not just related to climate change, but tobacco, the ozone hole, pesticides, this whole litany of things that we had witnessed over several decades, was all about refusing to accept the reality of market failure, refusing to accept that there are certain kinds of problems that are created by economic activity that the market simply has failed to address. And so now we fast forward to COVID-19. There's a piece of market failure in this. Obviously, the private sector didn't stockpile a billion masks. So in some sense, we can think of this as a market failure. But it's also a case where the whole mantra of individual responsibility fails. And of course, we know individual responsibility is one of the mantras of the American conservative movement. Well, individual responsibility is a great thing. I believe in it, but it has its limits. And we're seeing that in this case. And people who the sort of extreme individualists who don't want to accept that there are limits, there have to be limits to individual responsibility, we're seeing those people come out in force. But again, the good news is there's actually very few of them. And this is one of the problems that we have with this issue, and it is a problem in the media coverage too. Those protests in Michigan and wherever else they were got a lot of media attention, but if you actually counted the number of people there, it was a very, very, very small number of people. And if you count the number of Fox News commentators, they get a lot of, they make a lot of noise, they get a lot of attention. They have this giant bullhorn on Fox News. But, I mean, how many of them are really? Like 6, 8, 10 people? I mean, and all of the polls, poll after poll after poll, shows that the majority of American people reject this way of thinking. And we have seen in the last few weeks, actually, the amazing, impressive way in which the American people have stepped up to the plate and how people have stayed home. And opinion polls show that the vast majority of the American people say that protecting our health and our safety is more important than the economy. And so this tells us that what we really have to do is to kind of mobilize the majority and to focus on the majority and to remember that these extremists are exactly that. They're extreme, and they don't represent the majority of the American people. And they've pulled a kind of fast one on us to make us think that many of these arguments are 50-50. I mean, Mike and I have both written about this, right, to get the media to present, quote, both sides of the story, when in reality the weight of public opinion or the weight of scientific evidence is often 80-20, 90-10, or in the case of climate change, probably about 99.7 to 0.03.
Michael, can you hear Naomi better?
I can.
Okay, great. And what would you add?
Yeah, and so everything that Naomi has said is on point, and ideology clearly plays an important role here. But there's another ingredient. Ideology, in the absence of the sort of megaphone that the right now has available to itself in the form of the right-wing media and the massive spending by dark money groups, by plutocrats like the Koch brothers, the ideology alone would be, you know, the voices advancing that ideology would be marginal, as Naomi points to. It's a relatively small number of people who are actually participating in these protests. The problem here is what we call astroturf. We're supposed to think that this is a grassroots uprising of individuals arguing for freedom and opposed to the lockdown, when in fact it's the same dark money groups, the same plutocrats, the Koch brothers, the Mercers, who funded a massive AstroTurf campaign that we may still remember from about 10 years ago, the so-called Tea Party movement. We were supposed to think it was an uprising from the people, and a focal point of that movement was to head off efforts by the Obama administration to regulate carbon emissions. And so what happened was the Koch brothers and other dark money organizations created this fake movement. And what happens is they get, you know, the right-wing media, Fox News, the Wall Street Journal editorial pages, the New York Post, and the rest of them to help sort of to act as a megaphone. And actual people get drawn into it. So what started out as a highly orchestrated fake movement ultimately does bring out a sort of rabble, people who are disaffected, people are unhappy with their lives, and they're more than ready to look for a scapegoat, somebody to blame, whether it's these climate scientists who are trying to regulate carbon emissions and take away their SUVs, or these medical scientists like Fauci who have been shouted down, and it's a truly frightening development, in my view, to see experts like Tony Fauci shouted down in this way, simply because of the inconvenient nature of their message, which is that we do need to lock down. We are going to need to see some sort of economic slowdown, and the lockdown that is associated with it, if we are to prevent this from this pandemic from worsening. And so it's the same groups, it's the same moneyed interests who have a vested interest, in one case to prevent the regulation of carbon emissions, in this case to reelect Trump, who will help them again advance their agenda of deregulation, including efforts to prevent climate action. It comes down to the same thing. And it's a it's not a grassroots movement. It's a fake AstroTurf movement, but actual people get drawn into it. And so there are real people who are out there protesting. Some of them are probably paid, sort of professionals. We know that that was the case with the Tea Party, where Koch Industries was actually sending busloads of their employees to these demonstrations, again, to help provide the sort of the illusion of massive numbers of people demonstrating in the streets, when in fact it's really about the agenda of moneyed interests. And that's what we're seeing laid bare here. It's even more frightening in a sense because, well, the damage accrued because of climate change will be far greater than the damage and loss of life from this pandemic. The pandemic is playing out in real time, and so we're actually seeing in real time the tragic impact of the rejection of scientific guidance by the right for purely, monetary reasons.
That is Michael Mann, professor of atmospheric science at Penn State, with joint appointments in the Department of Geosciences and the Earth and Environmental Systems Institute, and director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Michael Mann is the author of several books, including The Madhouse Effect. Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science and an affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. She's the author of many books, including Why Trust Science and Merchants of Doubt. And I highly recommend checking out the documentary Merchants of Doubt. If you have any questions or comments for Professor Mann or Professor Oreskes, we'd love to hear from you. There's just a lot to discuss as we mark the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. How are we tackling the climate crisis? We're also talking about the connections to COVID-19 and ongoing climate denial. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. We have an email from Bill. He says, I've read that climate change research has been hit hard by the pandemic lockdowns, labs closed, field research, travel suspended. Also, I suspect the economic slowdown and pandemic focus will cause major reductions in research funding. What long-term consequences will all of this have on our ability to understand and fight climate change going forward? Naomi, do you want to take that first?
Well, probably Mike is in a better position to talk specifically about, what's happening to climate scientists. But I guess what I could just say is that I have great sympathy for scientists. I used to be one. My husband is one. But I think when it comes to climate change, the action really here now is no longer in the science. The basic science of climate change, the impact of greenhouse gases, the adverse effects that warming has on the planet, on people and ecosystems and our economy, all of this has been documented over and over and over again. We understand the scientific predicament very, very well. And the real challenge now is to get action on that scientific information. So I do, of course, think I want to see earth science continue. I am an affiliated professor of earth science here at Harvard. Obviously, scientists are being hit by this, as are everyone. But in terms of action on the issue, I think we know what we need to know to move forward to act.
And Michael, what would you add?
Yeah, I by and large agree with that. I have a slightly different perspective, of course, because I am ultimately a climate scientist, and I certainly am concerned about the damage that lockdown, the pandemic, could have when it comes to the continuation of basic climate services, the infrastructure that we have in place to actually monitor the climate, field campaigns by oceanographers and cryosphere studies, people who study the ice sheets, glaciologists, as well as oceanographers, atmospheric scientists, all of that sort of field work and those campaigns that are there to monitor what's happening are potentially impacted by this. Now, as Naomi notes, we don't need new data to tell us that we've got a crisis on our hands and it requires immediate action. But we do actually need the scientific guidance, projections, for example, climate projections that are used to gauge how much carbon there is left in our carbon budget. There's very important work that continues to be done that fundamentally is steeped in climate modeling and climate science, in looking at how far down the road are we and what do we actually need to do to avert committing to truly catastrophic planetary warming. The guidance for those decisions comes from climate models and climate science in general, and our ability to assess the damages, the impacts that climate change is having and may have. Again, that is steeped in basic climate science. So the work is important. Of course, you know, I don't want to be too parochial. Climate scientists, as Naomi alludes to, are like everyone else. We're all being impacted adversely by this crisis. And the key thing, in my view, is to take away the right lessons, as we were talking about earlier. What, you know, the right lessons. The wrong lesson would be, for example, I'll give one example here because it's important. It's been part of the sort of anti-scientific effort by the critics to discredit the science, both in the case of climate change and in the case of this pandemic. What you see are the critics saying things like, well, look, it isn't as bad as the scientists were predicting it would be. And with climate change, that's not really true. By many measures, it's worse. But what is true is we're on a better trajectory. We're unlikely to see quite as much carbon pollution over the next century as we feared we might a decade ago, and that's because of the message from the science and the messaging by the scientific community and those who communicating the implications of the science that have driven home the fact that we do need to, you know, shift dramatically from business as usual, and that's starting to happen. We're seeing it in the numbers. And so there is the tendency for the critics to say, oh, look, the carbon emissions aren't as bad as they said it would be 20 years. That's because, to some extent, we're starting to listen to the science. The same thing with this pandemic, right? The you know, the number of cases and deaths are likely to be substantially less than they would have in a scenario of business as usual. If we had failed to take action, then, yeah, we would have seen millions of cases potentially in the U.S. And hundreds of thousands of deaths. And we're likely not to see that because the lockdown is taking place, at least in many states, not quite to the level that we don't have the leadership that we would like to have at the presidential level, at the executive level, but enough states and localities are engaging in efforts to lock down that we're likely to see far fewer cases and deaths. And that's because of the science, because we listen to it. And so we have to keep that in mind when you hear somebody say something like, well, look, those model projections were completely wrong. We can't trust the scientists because, look, things aren't as bad as they said they were going to be. No, they're not as bad as we said they could be because we're actually listening to the science. And this is a point that Naomi has driven home, you know, in her writings, in her latest book, why it is so important to actually listen to science. We have perhaps the finest example in modern history of that here with this pandemic.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. That is Michael Mann, professor of atmospheric science at Penn State. We're also joined by Naomi Oreskes, professor of the history of science and an affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. And today we are talking about tackling the climate crisis as we mark the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. This is Your Calls, One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with veteran science journalist Miles O'Brien about his new frontline documentary, Coronavirus Pandemic. How did the United States become the country with the worst outbreak in the world? If you have a show idea or a guest idea or comments about the show, you can email us yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to join today's show about the climate crisis, as we mark the 50th anniversary of Earth Day, you can email yourcall@kalw.org or you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Today, we're joined by Michael Mann, professor of atmospheric science at Penn State. Author of many books, including The Madhouse Effect, Naomi Oreskes, professor of the history of science and an affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. Her latest book is Why Trust Science? It traces the history and philosophy of science from the late 19th century to today. She's also author of Merchants of Doubt. There's an incredible documentary out by the same name. We have a tweet from Leticia, and she writes, what about the road today? The narrative of return to normal is not helpful. I would rather go for inform, train, reflect, transform, and strengthen. What are your thoughts about that, Naomi? When we talk, I mean, this year, 50th anniversary of Earth Day, when we talk about the next couple of years and what really needs to happen, how are you thinking about that?
And I definitely agree with the listener. I think we need to find a road to a new normal. I think part of what people like Mike Mann and Bill McKibben and many others have been saying for a long time now is that there is something broken in our system. We have a system that operates with a kind of reckless disregard for what economists call the external costs, the true cost of burning fossil fuels. So we pay a certain amount of money at the pump, or we pay a certain amount of money on our electricity bill, but we're not paying for is the real damage that greenhouse gases from those fossil fuels are doing to people, to the environment, to the natural world. And that's a fundamental flaw in our system. And there are many ways it could be fixed. Economists have been putting forward all kinds of good ideas for a long time. But we have systematically, particularly in this country, but globally as well, really refused to take seriously that there are alternatives. And the same with technology. The good news about climate change is that most of the technology we need to fix this problem already exists. There are lots of credible studies now that show that here in the United States, we could power our energy system probably at least 80% with renewable energy, possibly more. In other countries like Australia, it's even higher. Australia could probably get 95% of its energy from renewables. So the technologies to use these, or sorry, the wherewithal to use these technologies, the technologies exist. But we have an economic system and a political system that is stacked against them, is stacked in favor of the incumbents, the fossil fuels. And so what we really need now is to think about how to find a new normal. And one thing that I think has been encouraging in the last few weeks is to see how much the American people, by and large, have responded, how so many people have put the health and safety of their neighbors and their friends and their parents, they've put other people's safety first. And I think this is a super important thing for us to attend to, because we often hear people say that the reason we can't address climate change is because the American people won't change, that the American people are too locked into their way of life, that we're too in love with our big cars and our big houses and our constant travel. And of course, many of us do enjoy a lot of nice material things, but COVID-19 has shown that we really can change, that we are willing to work together, that we are willing to work for the common good, and we are willing to take collective responsibility for all of our health and safety. So it's exposed the big lie of climate change denial. The big lie is that they say we can't, but really what it is that they won't. And now I think we could see a path forward where we all begin to say, actually, the sacrifices we need to make for climate change are very small, really, compared to the sacrifices we're making now. I mean, lots of us have given up a lot to stay home, to work from home if we can. Many people have given up their jobs completely, or not given up, that's the wrong term, have lost their jobs, have lost their income. People have lost a lot in the last few weeks. But if we think about climate change, I mean, I already shifted my house to solar panels about 7 years ago. My electricity is just as good as it ever was. My light bulbs burn just as bright. In fact, they burn brighter because they're now all LEDs. My co-author, Eric Conway, drives a Tesla, which is an amazingly great car. Not everyone can afford a Tesla, but there's lots of good electric cars out there. So many of the technologies that help us solve this problem are as good, if not better, than the incumbent technologies. So the sacrifice we need to make is actually less than what we're doing now. So again, I think that's grounds for optimism. And I think that's the story we need to tell, that we can do this, that we do have the technology we need, but we have to break the political power and the money chain that Mike was just talking about a few minutes ago. We have to break the power of the incumbents in order to create space for something that's new and better.
Mm. Michael, what would you add?
Yeah, so I agree with all of that. And individual action, behavioral change is an essential part of this transition. that we have to undergo towards a renewable, renewably driven energy economy and a sustainable planetary existence. That having been said, one of the lessons that we also have to take away from this current crisis is the limitations of individual action, behavioral change alone in the absence of the proper larger governmental incentives. And Naomi has alluded to this. The decrease in carbon emissions from everything, the entire lockdown, the fact that we're not driving and flying, the fact that we're doing so many of our meetings electronically, it's a massive shift over a very short period of time in our large-scale behavior. And yet the estimates are that that's only going to cut carbon emissions by maybe 5% or so. We need to bring them down by 7.5% a year for the next decade and beyond if we are to avert a catastrophic warming of the planet, more than 1.5 degrees Celsius, roughly 3 degrees Fahrenheit. If we're going to do that, we've got to bring carbon emissions down faster year by year than this pandemic alone will do this year. So it gives you an idea of the massive changes that we need and the fact that behavioral change alone doesn't get us there if there aren't changes in sort of larger systemic changes in the structure of our energy economy. As long as we're using energy and we're burning carbon to get that energy, we're going to be producing carbon pollution. And so one of the lessons here is that we do need policy. We need policy incentives for people to make the right choices, and we need politicians who are willing to do what's right for us rather than do what's in the interest of the powerful special interests, the fossil fuel interests, for example, that are essentially running energy and environmental policy under the Trump administration. And so this brings me back, I always come back to the same basic point. If we're going to see the sort of change that we need to see, we've got to show up at the voting booth. We've got a presidential election in less than a year, and you should be thinking when you go to the voting booth, first of all, you better go to the voting booth because there's never been a more important election, particularly if you care about the issue of climate change, where we have no time to waste. But think about climate change, not just at the very top of the ticket, but all the way down, because we don't elect politicians who are willing to go up against the powerful fossil fuel interest and do what's right by us. We're going to get business-as-usual policies, and we're going to continue down this dangerous highway. We have a choice, and we've got a very critical opportunity in less than a year to make the right choice.
Naomi, what are your final thoughts on that, just also the importance of the November election?
Well, I have to say I actually couldn't hear Mike. When you made me louder for him, I think he became quieter for me.
Okay.
I know he was talking about voting. But You know, obviously Mike and I are a friendly team, and we agree about just about everything. I guess what I would add to that is about the importance of narrative. I've been thinking a lot in the last few years, especially since working with Robbie Kenner, the great filmmaker who helped us turn our book into a film. Also, my other book that you didn't mention, The Collapse of Western Civilization, which is a sort of science fiction novella that tries to anticipate what this looks like if we continue to fail to act. I think part of the reason why conservatives have succeeded in this country far beyond their numbers, and I certainly agree with what Mike said about the money piece, it's the combination of money plus ideology that proves so powerful. But if you ask the question, why does the ideology work? I think that conservatives in this country have told a very persuasive story about individual responsibility and the magic of the marketplace and the inefficiencies of the federal government. The problem is that the story is untrue, but they've told it very well. And so I think that we, scientists, activists, historians, Democratic Party members, independents, we have to get together and we have to begin to articulate a clear and better vision of what the alternative looks like. And I think we have an opportunity here to remind people of some very old pieces of wisdom, namely that we are our brother's keeper, and we are all in this together, and no man is an island. And if one person gets sick, his neighbor gets sick. And this has been a reminder of the limits of the ideology of individualism. Sure, it's great for people to be able to make their own choices in many aspects of their life, and of course we all believe in liberty, right? But what this has reminded us is that we're a society, we're a community, and that we are all in this together. And I think that's the kind of meta message that I think COVID-19 has given us the opportunity to communicate. And that's the meta message that I think can mobilize people to work together, even while we may disagree about some of the details of policy.
Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science and an affiliated professor of earth and planetary sciences at Harvard University. Check out her new book, Why Trust Science, and a previous book, Merchants of Doubt, and a documentary, a must-see documentary by the same name. Naomi, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure to be here with you and Mike today.
You too. Thank you. Take care. Michael Mann is professor of atmospheric science at Penn State, the author of many books, including The Madhouse Effect. Michael is also very busy on Twitter. If you'd like to follow him, you can find him at our Twitter account, Your Call Radio. Michael, thank you for your work, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
All right. Thanks. Take care. Good talking with you.
Thanks.
Well, now we are going to talk about another way to celebrate Earth Day. Radio stations around the country and really around the globe, including KALW, are going to celebrate with a 24-hour real-time recording of wetlands in Santerna Island, British Columbia. The Tektexen Marsh is in the traditional territory of Wassenaq First Nation, and Santerna is on the U.S. border adjacent to the San Juan Islands in Washington State. As we continue to adjust to a new normal with the health and the financial impacts of the coronavirus, we thought a 24-hour audio retreat would be a nice and much-needed break. The broadcast starts at 12 a.m. Wednesday, April 22nd, and concludes 12 a.m. Thursday, April 23rd. Joining us to talk about the Wetlands Project are two guests. Brady Marks is a digital media artist whose fascination with sound and concern for our relationship with technology has led her to explore media art and generative soundscape composition. Hi, Brady. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Hi.
Hi. Great to have you. We're also joined by Mark Timmings, a multidisciplinary artist who explores perceptions of place by appropriating data and unfolding them into the domain of art. Hi, Mark. Thank you for joining us.
Hi.
Well, it's great to have both of you, and we're looking forward to airing this on KALW. In 2015, you both joined forces to collaborate on the Wetlands Project. Brady, talk about how you came up with this idea.
Well, I think the genesis of the idea is really Mark exploring his backyard. So he lives next to the this wetland, and his listening to his own environment and being sensitive to that. And then when we joined forces, my interest in slow radio and slow media, this sort of cultural phenomenon of like the opposite of fast food, and you've probably heard of slow food as well. Mm-hmm. And I was very touched by the phenomenon of slow TV that's actually been explored in various Nordic countries, and I wanted to bring that that idea to this project. So we sort of hybridized our concerns, and this project has various wings, but this slow radio is where we broadcast the sound, and the crucial point is that it happens at the same time that it was recorded. So when you hear, when you tune in at 10 a.m. or at 12 a.m., you're hearing the sounds from that time, no matter which time zone you're in the world. So you're really connecting to the original circadian rhythm, this idea of the soundscape, really tuning into what you feel and what you, I don't want to use the word should, but I'm gonna say what you should be feeling for that time of the day, because we're so we use media every day to sort of condition ourselves, and this is sort of the original conditioning of our psyches that our planet provided us, and it can be a wonderful way to sort of reconnect with that.
Well, let me play a little bit of what we can expect. I'm just going to play this from your website. I'm going to put my mic next to the speaker here. Let me just do this for a minute. Mm-hmm. And that is a taste of the Wetland Project. Mark, tell us a little bit more about what we can expect on Earth Day.
Well, as we know, it's a full 24-hour circadian rhythm. So I suggest sometimes people could perhaps put the radio on before they go to bed tonight or on Tuesday night and turn the radio on low. And through the night, there's the frog chorus, which is quite amazing and very full sounding. So probably turn it down a little bit for sleeping. And then if you do that, you will wake up to the dawn bird chorus, which is incredible with so many different types of birds, red-winged blackbirds, American robins. And that is in full force around 5:30 in the morning. So that's why it's good to put it on the night before so you don't have to get up so early. You can just like lie in bed and enjoy that. And it goes on, and then there's bird song and various sounds. There's also the sounds of airplanes flying over. This is a project about it's not like a spa piece. It is about the reality of our soundscape today. And then in the afternoon, you'll hear Canada geese flying over. You'll hear eagles. Around supper time, you hear the woodpeckers pecking and hammering away at trees, preparing their own dinner while you prepare yours. And then around 8:43 p.m., which is when the sun goes down and it gets dark, the frogs come back again and bring you back into that mode.
Tell us a little bit about these wetlands and the island's history. Mark, do you want to start off?
Yep. The wetland is actually just across the road from my home, and so I've been listening to it since 1997. And at one point I thought, wow, this is such an amazing soundscape, and I'm basically just not really listening to it very carefully. It's just part of my everyday background. So that's why we started the project, to really like explore what the sounds were like, what were the creatures doing at various times of day, and what were the names of the birds and the creatures that we were hearing. So we've learned a lot through the process. I should say that it is in the tradition of acoustic ecology, which is a movement which started in Vancouver 50 years ago at Simon Fraser University, where a young professor named Murray Schaefer began a small group of students where they pioneered a discipline which was about learning about human interaction with the environment through active listening. So that was part of our whole process. So, yeah, in Saturna, it's just a very small island. There's only 300 people. We're just basically surrounded. The U.S. border goes around three sides of the island. So we're looking over to the San Juan Islands from where we are. So it's a bit of an international site.
And what would you add, Brady? What do we need to know about this area as we listen to these sounds?
I think what we can think about is how the environment and how the soundscape really highlights how the environmental change is occurring. So, for example, Mark just mentioned that you will hear a lot of airplane traffic, and it's sort of a chance to check in with how you feel about that, what your emotional reaction is to different sounds, and what the wider implications are for those sounds. So we see it as a kind of a microcosm for environmental change. And like some people might have a negative reaction to the planes, but we've included everything. There's no editing. The whole 24-hour thing shows the cycle. I will say that something to reflect on during COVID-19 is now that plane traffic is would be highly reduced if we did the recording again this week. So we're going through a trying time, and the planet, the soundscape, will support us and will provide a nourishment, emotional nourishment, just as the environment provides physical nourishment. And we can take heart in how it is bouncing back, and it's taken so little in that we've just kind of kept to our spaces. And like, for example, the other day I heard Trump on the TV, but I also heard the birds in the Rose Garden, and I had never heard that before. So I think we really are, we're seeing our balance, and the balance sort of tipping back, and seeing that there is a potential. It's not that hard for us to take a step back sometimes and really listen to our environment and give it the place that it deserves in our lives.
Brady, I really like that. I was picturing the birds trying to send us a message from the Rose Garden. I had a similar experience in Golden Gate Park. It really hit me a couple of days ago. I said, for the first time, I hear the birds, not the cars.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think a lot of people are having this experience.
Somebody asked me if the birds were singing louder this year, and I said, I don't think they're singing louder. I think we can just hear them because we don't have as much traffic sounds and airplane sounds, and it made us listen, I think, more closely. And it's one of the things that the broadcast does. There's something special about listening to an intentional recording of the soundscape of the marsh that's different than even just standing at the marsh or, you know, going out into nature and listening. There's some kind of heightened awareness that comes out of it, and you just, because it's maybe taken out of context, and you become much more aware of the details, and it has this very, very kind of magical power, especially when you're listening over a long period of time, which this broadcast allows you to do. But the other thing about the broadcast is that you can go about doing other things while it's on. You basically can put it on the radio and cook and do any other activities. It doesn't require absolute attention all the time.
Your timing really is incredible when you think about it, because we're all just drowning in COVID news, and it can be at times overwhelming. I mean, we're talking about it every day on the show because people need resources and we want to be there for them. But at the end of the day, we all need a break. And so this will be nice just to sit with these beautiful sounds. I understand that you collected 32 continuous hours of data, and you obviously selected 24 hours and you processed it into a sound loop for broadcast. You talked a little bit, Mark, about some of the changes we can expect. What other changes really stood out for you?
What other changes in which sense?
In terms of what you heard.
You mean like from this year? Well, I've been listening to it live, actually, outside over the last few days, because we're right close to Earth Day. And it's the absence of the planes. Like in the recorded piece that everybody's going to hear on Earth Day, there's a lot of plane traffic going between the cities of Vancouver and Victoria. There's float planes, there's commercial planes. And it's interesting that you'll hear the planes at certain times of day, like when commuter traffic happens at the end of the workday. And so there's this kind of human circadian rhythm that's going on as well as the circadian rhythm that's governing all of the sounds that the creatures are producing too. But this year, the human one is a little more absent. And the creatures are absolutely unaffected by COVID, and they're just going on about their business as usual.
So we're going to listen to loops of sound in basically in real time?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. And final thoughts, Brady, what response did you get to this last time around when this aired on radio stations?
Well, it's been amazing, the response. because we have it on the website, and you can actually you can tweet at to us as well as a way of feeding back and having a sort of a parallel conversation that's not disturbing the soundscape. And people are really using it this year as a resource for to fight the anxiety that COVID-19 is producing, because it's a trying time and it's difficult to know sort of what to do. A lot of us are using media like Netflix, and this is a way to sort of open a window onto another kind of media, like I was saying, the original soundscape, the original Netflix, as it were. It's a way of surrounding yourself with something that will really give you a sense of place, a sense of time. I sometimes think of it as a clock that moves sort of slowly sliding forward rather than subdividing or chopping your day up. It'll make your day a very smooth whole rather than a segmented, divided a feeling.
Yeah. Well,
your question was, what have people said? People have reacted in so many different ways. For example, some people are surprised that their cats and dogs are intrigued by the soundtrack as well as they are. Mm-hmm. So they tell us that their cats are looking for the birds or are sort of energized by it. Some people react to the contrast between man-made and human and natural sounds.
I was going to say, you also kind of get into the rhythm of what's going on in nature. So as you're listening to it at home, it's the creatures kind of slow down in the afternoon a little bit, and it's kind of like nap time. And you find yourself kind of going on the couch and putting your feet up and getting into the rhythm of what's going on in the soundscape.
Well, thank you both so much for putting this together. Really, we really look forward to it. Brady Marks and Mark Timmings joined forces to collaborate on the Wetlands Project in 2015. On Wednesday, KALW will celebrate Earth Day with a 24-hour real-time recording of Wetlands in Saturna Island, British Columbia. Mark and Brady, thank you so much for your work. Thank you for joining us. And thank you for joining us.
You.
I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.